Okay, Tokyo, Australia, Germany.
Go head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. Answering question number one, yes, this program is live. It is the 13th day of February, 2017. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is where we all congregate, gather together, hang out, hoot and nanny, carry on, and otherwise have a real, real good time. I am, of course, Bob Kincaid, and I'm still here. I don't feel real good, but I feel terrible. Let's not kid ourselves. No, I'm still sick. I apologize. I tried to broadcast on Friday, but the White Rose Society server did not want to cooperate. Ben later told me we had apparently been nailed with a humongous attack. But he sorted that out, and consequently, Dr. Bill was live earlier this afternoon. And I'm live right now. Thanks, everybody, for letting me know that I'm live, and because we don't have what are called confirmation monitors here. It's not that kind of radio. But the stream's getting out, and I couldn't be happier. It's about 2 minutes past the hour. If you would like to get in on the madcap merriment that is the multimedia real-time extravaganza of the Horn chat room, just run on over to HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, click on chat room, pick yourself out a screen name and a password, and jump right in. I would tell you who's going to meet you there, save for the fact that I myself cannot get in. I don't know if this is because the machine inadvertently took a Firefox update, or just maybe because the tired old production machine is being recalcitrant. I told it I didn't want the goddamned update, but you know how it is. You know how it is with Microsoft and it, what? Oh, are we gonna? We're gonna. I'm in. Hot tickety damn.
I rule.
Yes. Well, okay, I'm in the room. Let's see if it's going to populate with any, people. Well, we'll find that out in short order. Okay, let's get this part. There we are. Okay, yeah, so if you pick out a screen name and a password and you go to the Horn chat room, you will be met immediately and greeted and welcomed even by Earther and Hoghead and Jug of Punch and Labor Man and Snork and Soapbox Geezer, and Steve from Georgistan, and VT Blom, all capably moderated by longtime, inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator, Sparky, who, things in Northern California being what they are, has decided that the better part of valor is not to fold space and to remain Sparky and not become man cave this evening. Last night, I didn't have it in me to fool around trying to watch the Grammys. I was absolutely, and I hope not morbidly, captivated by the live video that was coming from the Oroville Dam there, Bill, and not too terribly far from Chico, California. Hi, Tony. Oh, now the buffering thing. Oh, that's effing great. Settle down, damn it. You. Oh, okay. Even third stage guild navigators don't like mosquitoes, and Sparky tells me the mosquitoes are bad in the man cave right now. Well, stay away from the damn mosquitoes. You never know what could happen. You might wind up with a nasty case of hillbilly Zika, Ebola, Clama, Herpagonal syphilades. So just better off not messing with it. But this is Moran Monday, right? And just because I'm trying to keep things off on some of the shenanigans that go with Moran Monday, the silly voices and whatnot. Because, frankly, I don't feel good. And for people who think that I might have caught a bug or something, I haven't. This happens every so often. My insides decide to go sideways. And that means no food for me. I've been on a water and the occasional sugar-free popsicle diet since Tuesday night last. I am hungry as and unable to eat. But because it all, because it everything, my show is seeing back, I want my number up. I probably should have seen Agnes did, but she's ever so much smarter than me.
No, I'm not.
Yes, you are.
No, I'm not.
SMR.
I love you. I'm glad you think that.
But she saw it coming because my blood sugar numbers were bouncing. And bounce, they still, my blood sugar's up. And that's because part of this whole thing involves my pancreas enlarging and becoming exquisitely painful, which then puts pressure on a lot of, have you ever been in a place, and on top of it, it turns out there's some sort of bronchial, the respiratory virus thingy going on too, which makes me want to sneeze. The only thing is, there's a certain mechanism inside the human body that has to take place in order for a person to sneeze. I never could understand, and in many instances, it was a girl thing. When I was a little kid growing up, the girls would all go, and that was a sneeze. Whereas, you know, my idea was a sneeze, was a great roaring expulsion of air and things that we really don't want to talk about in the dinner hour. Well, I can't do that right now, even though there's some sort of, because in order to corkscrew up the necessary musculature, well, it hurts bad enough that I feel like something would probably rip loose if I actually sneezed. So if you've never been in the position where you are physically unable to sneeze and badly need to, it's kind of like a classic short story, science fiction short story from a million, billion, jillion years ago called For I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream. It's a particular flavor of hell. But anyway, so my guts are all messed up and can't really go to the hospital because I don't have any health care coverage. And so knowing what this probably is, we're treating it like we've always treated it in the past, to wit, lots of anti-inflammatories, the occasional little dose of miniature Limbaugh medicine. And a lot of time in bed. A lot of time in bed. I don't think I've even been outside the house since Tuesday. And that's really, really out of the ordinary for me. Agnes will appreciate your agreement. Carol Baker says of Agnes, yes, she are. She damn sure are. Meanwhile, in the far and frozen north, courtesy of Ron, Don't argue with the superior intellect, especially when there is no need. I ain't got to be told twice. Him can learn. Him can learn real good. It have taken him something on the order of 24 years to learn, but him have learned. So, anyway.
Just me checking on you, dear.
Thank you, beautiful.
You're welcome.
That's been kind of my week, and it's been a very unpleasant one. Pray God, whatever painful thing you endure. Here, let me put this. When one of these things hits me, and I'm not making this all about me. I'm trying to explain why I've been gone for the better part of a week. We knew why I was gone in early February. We had great success with the introduction of the AIC Act, the reintroduction of the AIC Act. We've got some tremendous, fabulous co-sponsors, and we'll be working more on that as the Congress continues, and as the ability of the AIC campaign to afford to go to D.C. develops. But I'm trying to explain my absence because, say whatever else about me, I try not to miss. I really, really try not to miss. I can't remember the number. I can't count because I don't remember it happening. The times that my dad missed work on the furnace. And I try not to just callously not be here. But I have not been here. I was not here Wednesday, Thursday, Friday of last week, except the abortive 30 minutes. And I couldn't stand not to be here this evening. Agnes can tell you she would rather I were not here now. But it makes me sicker than I already am not to be here, if that makes any sense at all. So here I am. But anyway, last night... Oh, well, no, let's get this out of the way. This here is what we call a listener-supported broadcast effort. If I were independently wealthy, if I hit some big-ass lottery jackpot, I would stop fundraising for this program with the very next broadcast. Hell, hand me never mind. That's just the short and simple of it. If, say, George Soros finally got a clue and realized the importance of this medium and, say, cut a $60,000 check to the horn, I'd stop fundraising. But as it is, this program and this network have existed as long as they have, and, you know, 13 years ain't shabby. That ain't just Whistlin' Dixie. On your continued support. And because of my absence, because of my illness, we are within the straits of our fundraising goals. Somewhere around $650 in the hole. I'll leave the cute little reverb off, but that's where it is. And it has real-world consequences. Things like, you know, internet bills and telephony and, lights, electricity, food when I can eat it, are part of it all. And so let me just say right off the top that we need to, if you are so inclined, we need to take a bite out of that $650 hole. It would be great if we could eliminate that $650 hole. Because after all, well, we've got Norsky nudging and Lithuanian licking to do for February. We managed to do that, do both for the month of January. Yay. Thank you, Chris, and thank you, Marcy. And, the long and short of it is, please, I'm saying please, if it ain't too much trouble, go to headonradionetwork.com, click on the Contribute tab, and do what you can. I can tell you that on this particular day of the month, and for the last couple of days, we have very, very few subscribers. It would be great to add in, say, five or six subscribers or more for this particular day. And if you want to do that, you just click the little box that says make this a recurring monthly donation, and we're off and running. So that's where we are. And hopefully we won't stay there. Hopefully we'll knock down that $650 to something much more manageable and much less terrifying in short order. I promise I'm going to bring this around and make it make sense sooner rather than later. Because there's a lot to talk about this evening. Let's see, note coming in from Paul from Parts Unknown. Paul from Parts Unknown says, sorry you're going through some rough gut times lately. I hope you got a chance to rest over the weekend and feel better. I'm rested till I'm sick of resting. It's the flop sweats and the up all nights and the can't get comfortables and the, but anyway, thank you, Paul. Paul continues, I thought I'd try to deliver some good news since things seem very bleak when it comes to current events over the past few weeks. As most of the community already knows, I work in the scientific field and hear a lot of science water cooler talk. And science water cooler talk has got to be some of the cooler water cooler talk. See, I ain't completely lost it. I can still do Art of Word Knowing things. A mineral has been found to possibly be the new material we will make the solar cells of the future from, and its name is perovskite. Perovskite. P-E-R-O-V-S-K-I-T-E, if you want to look it up. It's an organic-inorganic hybrid made with tin, lead, titanium oxide, and halides. Halides, that would be salt, right? Perovskites contain an entire family of different minerals with great applications for solar cells. There's an article on perovskites at The Guardian. I bet if you go to The Guardian and just put perovskites in the search box, it'll pop. And there's also an article at nanowerk.com, N-A-N-O-W-E-R-K. A recent Science Alert article states that we're already seeing solar cells with a certain perovskite mineral that captures 16.5% of solar energy and could be as high as 22.1% by the end of 2017. Current silicon panels are doing outstanding if they capture 4%. Wow. This is a major breakthrough because the goal of solar capture has always been 10% or more. In the late 1970s, during the Carter administration, the Department of Energy issued a report on the economic viability of using solar cells as a replacement for power plants, and the report concluded that solar cells would have to capture at least 10% of the sun's energy to do this. We could be seeing fully functional solar plants by the early 2020s, and even perovskite solar panels on rooftops before 2020. This is a game changer, and if true, is a death knell for the fossil fuel industry. It is important to remember in these bleak times when we are building a wall on the Mexican border for a mere $40 billion, roughly around $23 million a mile, or roughly $13,000 a yard, which seems very much on the low side to me, and barely any room for anyone to get their beaks wet. And that's what it's all about, the beak wetting. There are people working hard to build a future worth living in, rather than the post-apocalyptic moonscapes others are intent on making for profit today. I thought everybody could use a little hope this week. Now brace yourselves. Brace yourself, Eunice. Now brace yourselves. Here comes the rest of the week's news. My love to the Horn community. Paul from Parts Unknown. Thank you, Paul. Thank you so very much. I do appreciate it, and as soon as the program's over, I'm going to go and read everything my little eyeballs can see about perovskite. I'm fascinated, but not to be the eternal pessimist that I'm naturally inclined to be. I have to worry a little bit. I wonder where perovskite is found, or mined. Please, if you want to make me even happier, Paul, tell me that we can make this in a lab or something. Halides, a little tin, a little lead. Or that maybe there's enough recoverable, recyclable tin and whatnot to make a whole bunch of this stuff. Because that's the downside. Anytime I always think, because my dear friends, the Bad River Band of the Ojibwe people taught me this when I was up there years ago. The Ojibwe live in an area that is rich in copper and iron. And of course, the beginnings of all metallurgical culture is the discovery of copper, which you can hammer into something without even heating it. And from there, the curiosity kicks in, and there was lots of... But along the way, the Ojibwe people decided they were not going to take that route, that they were pretty happy with the lives that they had, and that consequently they would enact a rule among them that said you could only dig that nobody could dig any further than, 2 feet into the earth. And, this is the kind of stuff that you have to do for building the substrate of one's home. It is, after all, northern Wisconsin and southern Canada. And so I worry anytime that I see something that has to be mined for. Because anytime something has to be mined for, some poor people somewhere are going to get screwed. Because oddly enough, I don't know how this always works out this way, but the incredibly valuable deposits of mineral wealth never seem to be underneath any capitalists' mansions. Yeah, you know what I mean? So I guess that's my only concern, and I suppose that marks me as a miserable little concern troll going forward. And I don't like being a concern troll because it puts me in the camp. I realized earlier today that that's all John McCain and Lindsey Graham and all these so-called principled Republicans who are certainly not particularly happy with Donald Trump, but goddamn, we're going to get everything we ever wanted out of this son of a bitch, and who cares if he's barking fucking mad out in the middle of Pennsylvania Avenue? Hell, that's on him, not on us. Let him bark. I mean, he can pee on people like a skunk for all we care. We're getting what we want. We're going to kill Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, and there's going to be block grants for Republican governors to use to not do what the block grants were for, but instead buy themselves Frisbees and wheat checks for all their goddamn donors. Are you kidding? You really think we're going to take action against Trump? And so they walk around and they do their concern trolling thing. Well, mercy sakes, said Lindsey Graham, I don't appreciate his combative tone, but goodness me, as he collapsed onto the fainting couch, muttering "Help me, John," on the way down with his gin and tonic firmly in hand. meh. So I don't want to be that. Oh, good. I'm glad to know my obscure little references don't go without note. Marty says, for I have no mouth and I must scream, from the fertile mind of one Harlan Ellison, author of The Glass Teat, amongst other things. Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. Thank you. That'll be cool. Carol says, I will ask my neighbor. He's part of the Ojibwe tribe. I bet he'll tell you. Yeah, you're not supposed to dig deep in the earth. Or at least that's not, at least that was, you know, that's the way it is up there. And it doesn't seem to have cost them a lot either. And of course, that was part of the operating philosophy that allowed them to tell a badass renegade coal mine, mountaintop removal, strip mine, and hillbilly Chris Klein to go mountaintop removal himself. And the Pinokies are not blown away and are in fact still standing majestically proud just south of the shores of Lake Superior. But anyway, just trying to keep some semblance of continuity here. Oh, who am I fucking kidding? That left a long time ago. I couldn't fool around with the Grammys last night because I was busy watching the live coverage of the Oroville Dam. Because there is something... true. Arthur says, we've never seen Paul Ryan happier on TV than we see him these days. Hi, Brother Bob. Hope you get better. Thank you, Arthur. And that's true. Arnold tells me, most indigenous tribes feel that you should not dig into the earth. I, too, will find out the exact measurement, but I believe it only far enough for either burial or home building. Okay, back to the Oroville Dam, because this actually means something. The background on this is that the rains that have rained upon Northern California almost incessantly over the past couple of months have, well, talk about feast or famine. Drought a couple of years ago, and now Northern California has more water than it can handle. And so when the Oroville Dam was designed in the 1950s and constructed in the mid to late 1960s, it created the second largest reservoir of water in the entire state of California, which is a good thing because there are parts of California that can damn sure use it. What happened is the rains that have come have filled up Oroville Lake, and even with the spillway wide open at the dam, it was still filling up. So they designed into it an emergency spillway, an auxiliary spillway. And that thing no sooner was let to function than officials realized that, hey, this thing's going to fail. And that when it failed, hell itself was going to yawn right open in a 3-county area south of the dam. Massive flooding on, you know, a humongous natural disaster level. And for those of us who are not Californians, generally, we're not used to California having any sort of water-related natural disaster. We expect California to have earthquakes and forest fires. And if we think that way, it's possible Californians think that way, too. And so last night, I was transfixed as I watched the highways in Oroville via a helicopter shot become a parking lot of people trying to get the hell out. Something like 188,000 people evacuated. And not out of the woods yet, because the weather forecast called for, you know, more rain. I know. Rain. It go down, you know, take the 6 7/8 to the 9 3/16 somewhere in L.A. and say fucking rain and watch somebody slap you in the face, I guess. But more rain. So I was watching that, and because it's more in Monday. Oh, I know you have. Sparky tells me in the chat room, we have floods, Bob Kincaid. I know. But we... For a lot of us on this side of the continent, California could just as easily be Mars, and that's not an insult. It's just because if California is Mars to a hillbilly, then West Virginia must certainly be some little isolated frozen rock outside out beyond the orbit of fucking Pluto, if it's even a planet. To y'all, I understand, but it's more in Monday. And being as how it is more in Monday, there's this. Sometimes, and maybe it was the drugs, I find myself thinking something, and then the something happens. Because the something I was thinking was, gee, I wonder who the congressman is for that neck of the woods and whether, since it's Northern California, he might be some birther, bagger, bircher, booger eater, ninther, denther, deather, tenther, you know, Republican. Guess what? He is. Oh, Lordy, yes, he is. Because no sooner had I wondered than, by God, they had him on the phone there at whatever TV station it was I was watching. And for about 2 minutes, he sounded pretty sane. His name is Doug LaMalfa. Malfa, I don't know, L-A-M-A-L-F-A. He's a rice farmer. Over the years, he and his family have gotten something north of $5 million in welfare from the government for their rice farm. He's a proud graduate of Cal Poly San Luis Obispo and has a bachelor's degree in agribusiness. He and his wife, Jill, along with their four children, live on the family rice farm in Richvale, an unincorporated suburban community south of Chico, founded by his great-grandfather in 1931. Okay. He's a founding director of the California Rice Commission from Butte County. Okay. He's part of the Domestic Promotion Committee of the USA Rice Federation, or has been. But now, he is the member of the United States House of Representatives from the 1st District of California. And he's a mess. Because like I said, there was about 2 minutes before I went, well, that didn't take long. And then I went to check out some more about him. And there he is. He's all concerned about the family values and doesn't like for the homos to be getting all married up. Uh-huh. Early active supporter of Proposition Hate, among other things. Yeah. He's also a bigot. Now, this is a guy who runs rice farms, right? Who do you think harvests the rice? He authored a bill when he was in the California Assembly that was very similar to Arizona's law, that would let law enforcement officers act as immigration customs enforcement agents. mercifully, his bill, which was ACA 20, failed to pass by a 3-6 vote when he first introduced it in the assembly. On the other hand, because freedom is constantly on Doug LaMalfa's mind, he successfully passed in 2007 something called AB 1645. And that prevents seizures of firearms in the event of an emergency or a natural disaster. So there, as the emergency spillway began to fail in Oroville, his constituents could take great comfort, I suppose, in the fact that they could have their shooting arm to shoot at the floodwaters and show them a thing or two when the godless liberal commie floodwaters. But, oh, Jesus. Back when he was just a mere assemblyman, the California Rifle and Pistol Association gave him Legislator of the Year, which he called a truly humbling honor. He got right pissed off a few years back opposing a bill in the California Assembly that would have told teachers in all California public schools to teach about history and civil rights of the gay community. Of Jerry Brown 2.0, he said, "He's out of touch with what I think are still mainstream American values. That's not the kind of stuff I want my kids learning about in public school. They've really crossed the line into a new frontier." Because Doug LaMalfa wants to live in a world where, there just aren't any homosexuals. And if there are, they can live in the shadows and pay their taxes, and that'll be fine. But not be doing all those homo things, out where the rest of us can see it, like getting married and loving each other and holding hands or going to the grocery store together or anything like that. Ew. Ow. Why did I run off to find out all this stuff about Doug LaMalfa, Moran? Because, like I said, after about 2 minutes of sounding reasonably sane and saying things like, well, we just need people to be orderly in their evacuation of the area, panic doesn't do anyone any good, and it makes the situation potentially even more dangerous. Okay, I got buy-in on that. And then, without even having a question asked of him by the talking head from the TV news operation, unbidden, sprang forth from his mouth like some sort of Moran Venus from the head of Zeus, he uttered the words, "Of course, the environmentalists will be saying we have to get rid of all the dams now." Oh, my aching back. There wasn't an iota of evidence to support it. Tree beard and celery didn't have their hacky sacks and tempeh sandwiches tucked in their back pockets, marching with signs in front of the spillway saying, "Hell no, the dam's gotta go." God damn! Of course, the environmentalists will be saying now that they've got to get rid of all the dams. No, not at all. However, and I have my good friend Mike Roselle to thank for this, Roselle pointed out that in 2005, in a legal filing with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, for relicensing, Friends of the River, and that would be the Feather River, I believe, and Sierra Club, California, they submitted the following in regard to the emergency spillway, not the whole dam, the emergency spillway. a single operational use or multiple operational uses with failure to repair any preceding or cumulative damage of the ungated spillway could result in a loss of crest control of Oroville Dam. A loss of crest control could not only cause additional damage to project lands and facilities, but also cause damages and threaten lives in the protected floodplain downstream. An unarmored spillway is not in conformance with current FERC engineering regulations. Yep, there's your environmentalist claiming that all the dams have to go. Goddamn dummy. Moran. Jesus! These people. And that little paragraph there is precisely what happened. And so along the way, in listening to the talking head and the people that they managed to get on the phone, I heard, nobody could have predicted this. Well, nobody except Friends of the River and the Sierra Club of California, I guess. Sheesh. Okay, wait a minute. That's for Barkway in the chat room. Those idiots probably think crest control has something to do with toothpaste. Ah. And by unarmored spillway, they mean just kind of letting the water go over the top and down in a sort of generally redirected, which is exactly what happened. And they started using it, and the water poured. Oh, God, it poured. And then they looked up and went, well, son of a bitch, that damn thing's going to fail. Fuck! Because it did. Was. And so now, even after this crisis is over, Doug LaMalfa, who I'm sure is a fiscal conservative, you got to wonder where he's going to come down, Moran, on the idea of the necessity of fixing the said unarmored spillway. Or maybe even consider whether maybe that ought to be an armored spillway. Oh, well, looks like we're passing them out early this evening. Snork following up. We don't need to get rid of all the dams. We need to get rid of all the damn idiots. Well played, sir. Well played. Moment. So that's just our first Moran. Meanwhile, I had this vision of nobody even bothering to tell Geezer Disgustus that there was a potential disaster looming out in California, because, well, you know, hey, Geezer Disgustus hates California. Remember, he said California is out of control. Meanwhile, Gerald says, I see people on Facebook sending prayers for the Oroville victims all over my Facebook feed. I'm sure everything is going to be just fine. For someone. Well, assuming that the Almighty isn't busy helping some golfer make a 3-foot putt, and right, yeah, yeah. Now, well, long as Oroville has them thoughts and prayers, and Doug LaMalfa, he had him some thoughts and prayers too. Yeah, is that the region? By the way, him being a rice farmer and everything. Is that the region where we learned that it turned out that rice grown in California, even the organic stuff, had shockingly high levels of some sort of toxic, oh my God, what or another, mercury, lead, maybe arsenic, barium, cadmium, something. Is that the same place? Yeah, I wonder how many bills Doug LaMalfa's introduced to mitigate whatever poison that was. One of the shelters that opened up for refugees from the potential disaster area was even in Sparky's hometown. Sparky told me he was about 60 miles north of Oroville. Beautiful country up there. But I thought Sparky, being by far the greater expert on this topic, I thought it might be beneficial to check in with him. Hey, Sparky.
Hey, Bob.
How are you?
You had me kicking furniture here when you started bringing up Doug LaMalfa.
Okay, so he's a dick, right?
Oh, I hate him with a passion.
Your congressman?
Yes. The district runs. The first congressional district runs all the way down to Butte County. South of Butte County is John Garamendi's district.
Okay.
You heard Marysville, Yuba City.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, those are in his district. Now, as far as the evacuation last night, everybody came out of Oroville. They had two routes to get out of there. One is 162. It goes straight across the valley over to Interstate 5 south to Willows, or they could go north to Chico, of course. They had the fairgrounds, and Chico is an evacuation area. I don't know if they've got anything here, and if they opened up the fairgrounds here in Red Bluff. But we're 60 miles from Oroville north. You got to come through Chico to get to me, so... But the road that comes out of Oroville is Highway 70 North, and it's a freeway as it goes through Oroville, and then it cuts down to two lanes as it goes up into the mountains. But then there's a cutoff that goes over to Chico, so they closed off the southbound lane. I mean, coming into Oroville, they closed all the lanes off. And they closed all the lanes coming south out of Chico, so everybody from Oroville could drive right straight to Chico without oncoming traffic on the two-lane roads and everything, so they could get more people into Chico. And I'm sure a lot came further north here to Red Bluff, because we're 40 miles north of Chico as the crow flies. And I don't know if you saw the feed from the helicopter last night as he was flying back to Sacramento?
No, I saw it. I saw it when they were right over the dam. Eventually, their Facebook feed collapsed. I think they got just swamped.
Oh, well, I was watching KCRA.
Yeah, that's what I was watching.
And as he flew back to Sacramento, the traffic was really heavy coming out of, because they made all the people in Yuba City and Marysville evacuate. You know, there was two ways out of, there's one way out of Yuba City, basically, and that's south going on 99 towards Sacramento. But Marysville, you could go on Highway 70, which runs into 99 just north of Sacramento quite a ways, and then go that way, or you can go into the mountains on Highway 20, and Highway 20 had just a string of cars, and that goes up to Grass Valley, California. Is pretty famous in Nevada City.
Well, so, I mean, they got everybody evacuated eventually, didn't they?
Yeah, the evacuation's still on, but there's over 100,000 people have evacuated.
And, I mean, are people still leaving?
I'm sure they've got everybody out as far as they know. They brought cops in from other counties.
Well, I think this way. In situations like that where the able-bodied are able to, you know, get up and get out, you know, that's one factor. But what of elderly people in nursing homes and fragile people of less abledness?
I heard they were having some problems with getting people out of Oroville Hospital. But Oroville Hospital isn't that close to the river. I worked on it years ago.
But in this situation, that close to the river becomes an extremely relative term, doesn't it?
Yeah, because there's a lot of levee systems down there that are on the sides of the river. Now, if the levee fails, it just lets the water just go and run wild because the land's pretty flat down there, so it just go wherever the water wants to go.
Yeah, water will, after all, seek its own level.
Yeah, I found that out a couple of years ago when I was flash flooded.
Yeah, it seems like such a simple statement. Water always seeks its own level until you watch it in action, and then it becomes a pretty profound force.
Yeah, it does. We had 14 inches of water around the house during that flash flood, and once it made its appearance, it didn't take long for it to disappear because it had to go. It ran somewhere, basically flatland here.
Yeah, so I mean, water doesn't say to itself, "Gee, this seems like a pretty nice place. I think I'll stick around for a while." If there's somewhere lower it can go, it's going to find a way.
Now the other thing. People might want Lake Shasta is almost full too.
Oh, so we could have another one of these in the offing?
No. Shasta Dam won't fail. I don't doubt if it'll fail. They haven't even opened the drum gates yet. They can let a hell of a lot of water out there, but if they have to do that, there'll be a lot of flooding downriver. As it is right now, the flooding is minimal, but I've never seen the water going through Red Bluff as high as it is right now and rushing through. Our local city park is flooded in areas, and there's one little park.
What river? Now, it's the Feather below the Oroville Dam. What is that in below Shasta?
Sacramento River. That's the headwaters of Sacramento come right.
And Sacramento is just one great big-ass floodplain, right?
Yeah, it goes all the way down the valley to the city of Sacramento.
That's what I meant, the city. It's just one big-ass floodplain.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. So there's
areas that have been flooded there before down there, too.
So what's the status of the Oroville situation? What's the status of the dam right now?
Well, they're trying to get the water out of the dam, out of the lake to be 50 feet below the 50 feet lower than it is now. And last I heard, they've only made it about 3 feet lower than they want it. But the water stopped flowing over the emergency spillway, and they're trying to make repairs to it. They're using helicopters to dump boulders and rock into the crevice. I don't know if you saw it, but there's a crevice right by the spillway.
Yeah,
the
normal I did see
spillway.
It.
They're going to try and fill that in so the water won't undermine the because the emergency spillway, all it is a sheer face of concrete that's built down into the bedrock.
Yeah.
And so what they're worried about is the water undermining that concrete face, and then a whole concrete face that would crack and let go, and then Katie barred the doors.
And that's what they were afraid of happening last night, right?
Yeah.
It has not thus far happened, though.
No. But the evacuation order is still into effect.
Well,
they don't really know what they're going to do after this next storm comes.
And that's the
and
next
it's
thing.
It's a warmer storm, too, so it may melt a lot of snow.
Jesus, and that's like in the coming week, right?
Yeah, the storm is moving in on Wednesday afternoon,
and it's going to be rain in mid February. I mean, you and I have joked a lot about, well, you know, winter's a day and a half long where you are, but should this time of year should that be snow? at least in the northern, in the higher altitudes.
Yeah, but the snow level begins to fluctuate come February. It starts to rise. But the past years, we've had little to no rain or snow. So, I mean, if you realize how big Lake Shasta is, it rose 24 feet in 10 days. And it has 352 miles of shoreline around the whole, if you go drive around the whole lake, it's 352 miles.
Well, that's more math than I can do, but that's a whole shitload of water.
Yeah.
I heard the use of a particular term, acre feet of water, last night, and I was just silly enough to go and look it up and went, well, that's going to make my head hurt. Probably better not do that under the circumstances.
Yeah, so, that's how they measure what's behind the dam.
So has anybody out there mentioned this Sierra Club Friends of the River report from 2005? That kind of blew my mind.
Yeah, it's been all over the news.
I mean, they sort of predicted this, didn't they?
Yeah, and there's a lot of pissed off people. There was a Butte County supervisor on one of the shows last night that was pissed as hell about that. He said they didn't. He brought it up. Because there are some smart people in Butte County. That's where Chico State is.
Yeah.
And so that blew my mind. That's when I first heard it. And then I heard John Garamendi get on there last night. And he was saying Trump should help fix this. The spillway here instead of building a goddamn wall.
Well, you know, kind of good for him. I mean, right?
I wish he was my congressman instead of the idiot I got. And I wanted to mention one thing. Rice farming isn't Mexican intensive. I don't know if you saw my little...
No, I didn't see it. It's not.
No. No, it's done by machinery, and white guys can run machinery just fine.
Oh, okay. Okay.
It's that manual labor stuff that they don't like.
So why is it that you know, one district away you can have John Garamendi, but but you're stuck with Doug LaMalfa? Because state of Jefferson, right?
Yeah, it's just a different state of mind up here. And the closer you get to the cities, I mean, they're more liberal. You take that one guy, Tom McClintock, or whatever his name is, that they had in Roseville.
Yeah.
He represents the more of the foothill counties like Placer and Nevada County, where Grass Valley, Nevada City is. Except Grass Valley, Nevada City are pretty liberal place, but there's still a lot of just plain loony people. And there's a lot big retirement areas. People move out of Southern California, We call the immigrants. I mean, I've lived my whole life. We've always hated L.A. and San Francisco Bay Area immigrants because they always come up here, sell out from their houses down there and come up here and build big fancy McMansions and everything. And then they just become Republicans. And
you don't think they were Republicans to start?
Well, they could have been, but they're just more of I got mine, fuck you. You know,
yeah, the Igum Foo bunch, sure.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well,
there's a lot of working people up here that just plain don't vote.
No, that's the problem across the country. You know, I was talking to Ben Birch earlier today, and he was talking about impeachment, 25th Amendment, stuff like that. I said, you know, we could make a big difference by just getting that 48% of people who can't be bothered to actually participate in their country.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there, when you think about the 48% who don't vote, the image I came up with, they're civic lampreys. Isn't it? It's the lamprey that attaches to the side of a whale or a shark or whatever and just kind of rides along, feeds off the, you know, and, you know, does no work of its own. Well, that's the 48% of America that doesn't vote. And I'm not saying they all got to vote Democrat. They vote however the hell they want. We might find out we got a far worse country than we think we do. But if they actually participated, we might not have some of the problems we've got.
Let me tell you, getting a lamprey attached to you is very scary.
Oh, I don't even want to think about it.
I've had it happen to me when we used to dive gold mining. The Klamath River, they used to have lampreys that came up that river from the ocean.
That sounds like so much not fun that I never want to do it.
And you look down, and all of a sudden they were hooked onto your wetsuit trying to get a hold of you.
Oh, that's just too creepy. I'll have to think of a lot of different things before I even try to go to sleep this evening. Sparky, thanks a bunch, man.
All right. Thank you, Bob.
Take care. I appreciate the update. We all do.
Okay.
Bye now. That's our buddy Sparky, who's up in the up north of the affected area from the Oroville Dam. It's about a minute past the hour. We'll take a little break here. I can happily announce that thanks very kindly to Charlene, and thanks very much to Randy. And to Fab, thanks Fab. Of the 650 we needed to raise this evening, we've raised 300. And Randy wants the $50 to stand as a challenge. And so there it is, a $50 challenge on the table. So if that gets met, that'll take us down to $300 to go. Thank you. Thank you very much. Randy and Charlene and Frank, Fab, thanks a ton. Because that gets a little scary when the numbers start climbing up like that. Let's take a break. There's some other stuff I want to get to. So I'm going to be a couple of minutes taking any phone calls. Because, you know, like I said before, you can't keep up, so you just kind of got to jump in medias res. And there are a couple of topics that I want to hit before we go to the conversation radio part of it, where, you know, I don't know how much coverage there's been out there, but I want to make sure that we get that we at least make a yeoman effort here. This is listener supported conversation radio. This is the horn. I'm Starvin' Bob Kincaid.
Thank you.
Don't play a lot of Led Zeppelin here, but that seemed appropriate, and I've always loved that song anyway. Of course, that's a cover of an old blues tune, When the Levee Breaks. It is 8 minutes past the hour here on Moran Monday on the Horn, and I'm proud to say thank you very kindly to Keith that $20 of Randy's $50 challenge has been met. Thank you very kindly. So we're on the way to only having $300 worth, $300 more dollars to raise to knock down the, fill in the great big gaping hole. Notes, a few notes coming in. James writes, it says, my ears perked up when I heard about the Oroville Dam crisis. I can still remember my dad coming home late after working overtime on that dam for months. I'd hate like hell to see it fail. Yeah, I mean, I think Sparky's dad worked on it too, and it is dams are engineering marvels. It takes a lot to be able to hold back. Well, I don't have to say it, but the thing with dams is that they have to be constantly and appropriately maintained, and we live in a country that just doesn't think that's a sexy enough use of our dollars. I mean, I grew up in an area where the creation of a dam helped to alleviate a mosquito population that made yellow fever an ongoing threat for generations. And, there in the northwest corner of Alabama. Wilson Dam on the Tennessee River was such a success that Henry Ford said, well, now that we've spent federal tax dollars to build that sucker, I think I'll just buy it from you, and I'll use the hydroelectric power to run my burgeoning automotive empire. And so Muscle Shoals, the main drag, I've mentioned this before, the main drag in Muscle Shoals is called Woodward Avenue, just like Detroit. And he built a little planned community called Ford City, and by the time I was a kid, it was just weeds surrounded by sidewalks. Kind of creepy even. But back then we had a government said that said, no, Henry, no, we're not going to let you take all this electricity and just use it for yourself. We're going to use this for the betterment of all the people in the region. And that's what happened. But they have to be maintained. And that takes money. And we don't want to spend that kind of stuff right now. Note coming from Robert in Australia. You're going to love this. I mean, this is just, it's just beautiful. Glad to hear you're feeling a little better than last week. Thank you, Robert. News from Australia. You may or may not be aware here in Australia, but we're having a little bit of a heat wave. I am aware because I saw a photograph earlier today of like hundreds of fox bats, flying foxes, they were referred to as. Hundreds had just died off in New South Wales because they can't stand the heat. So they exited their presence on this little blue-green marble time machine hurtling through the universe. They got burnt to death. I mean, not on fire, it's just too damned hot. They couldn't live. Robert continues, here in Sydney, we've had a couple of 105-degree Fahrenheit days followed by 86-degree Fahrenheit nights. South Australia relies massively on renewable energy, and they had ongoing blackouts last week due to load shedding as demand outstripped supply. Okay, so far? Okay. As it turns out, these weren't necessary, as a backup power station was ready to go online. But no one thought to ask them. So they didn't. And they left people without power instead. Gee, I wonder why. Now, here's the answer. The federal government took this as an opportunity, and you know, that includes Malcolm Turnbull, who is a conservative politician, and yet Trump couldn't get along with him. Right. The federal government took this as an opportunity to state that renewable energy wasn't up to supplying power to the country. When it's hot and the wind isn't blowing, the turbines don't turn. Yeah, it's almost like somebody's been... Are you sure there aren't some, like, illegal alien hillbillies down there in Australia, Robert? You know, from the coal industry or something? Oh, no. Listen. Your only hope is coal. Joe Manchin once infamously said, renewable energy may be great 100 years from now, but that's the energy of the future. Coal is right now. Yep. So Robert says that's when they took the opportunity to introduce a lump of coal in the federal parliament. I'm not kidding. You get snowballs. We get lumps of coal. This is coal. There's no need to be afraid, said the treasurer, Scott Morrison, as he held it up. This lump of coal was handed around the members of Parliament while the rest of Australia baked. And yes, they're calling for the building of more coal-powered electricity stations. A record-breaking heat wave across all of southern Australia, and our government's solution is burn more coal. How do these clowns get elected? And what planet are they living on? I just don't know anymore. Talk about living in bubbles. And see, that's proof positive of my point. I just said a few minutes ago we need the 48% of civic lampreys to actually start voting. Australia has mandatory voting. And yet they've got people who bring coal to Parliament for show and tell. Because money. So go figure. But of course you've got that awful, what's her name, Pauline Hanson down there. She eats ground up coal on her post toasties every morning. Robert says, on Saturday, February 11th, high summer up over down under, I woke up and the power was off. It came back on at 9 a.m., went off at 12 p.m., came back on at 2 p.m., then went off at 5 p.m., and didn't come back on until 1 a.m. on Sunday. It was a 105-degree Fahrenheit day. I thought it was related to issues in South Australia. This blackout was limited to areas in North Ryde, where I live. It wasn't major. Transformers at the local electricity substation simply got too hot and switched off to prevent damage. Living without electricity for most of the day was an interesting experience. The transformers got too hot and they shut down. That's kind of like down at the Browns Ferry nuclear plant in Alabama when the Tennessee River got too hot and the water was no longer sufficiently cool enough to be used in the cooling tower, so they had to shut down the reactor because they couldn't cool it anymore because the river water was too hot. Ow, the stupid. Ow. Thank you, Robert. So, we got that. Now, something that I specifically wanted to get to, because like I said... okay, thank you. Steve from Georgistan. When the Levee Breaks, first recorded by husband and wife Kansas Joe McCoy and Memphis Minnie in 1929, in response to the Great Mississippi Flood of 1927. Randy Newman wrote a great song about that, too. Now, I mentioned, like I said, that there was something I wanted to get to because it's sort of West Virginia specific. But it has sort of national overtones because it involves a national personality. And to the extent that people may not have heard about it, it's a pretty egregious little piece of work. And deserves a wider, it needs to be shared around. People need to know what kind of miserable Stalinist little government we've got going on here. Had everything gone according to plan, I would have been sitting here this evening telling you about the day I had in McDowell County, West Virginia. Because, and I would be telling you in, 22 minutes to tune into MSNBC to watch the town hall forum with Chris Hayes and Bernie Sanders live from Welch, West Virginia. Or not live, but, recorded live. It's been in the works, and they talked about it on air. It's been in the works for over a month and a half. These things don't just happen on a dime. Long while back, because Bernie said, during the primary season, Bernie came to West Virginia, and he went to McDowell County, West Virginia, because it is one of the poorest counties in the entire United States. As I've discussed in the past, a man in McDowell County has the same life expectancy as a man in Haiti, and slightly less than a man in Guatemala. And Bernie Sanders was impressed both with the people in McDowell County and with what has been done to them. And so he wanted to talk more with the people of McDowell County, and the people at MSNBC said, sure, Bernie, we'd love to be part of that. We'd love to help you do that. Chris Hayes is really, really good people. And so they set about to get a venue, and they did. And they signed the papers and the payment agreements and all of that stuff. And they were going to use, because just to let you know a little bit about West Virginia, there are counties here where the biggest space you can have for a group gathering is the local National Guard Armory. And that's the same in a lot of rural America. I mean, I've made jokes in the past about, going to the wrestling next Saturday night down to the Guard Armory when the Red Menace will take on the Blue Marauder. And then over at the Army, because over at the Armory, one county over on Friday night, the Blue Marauder had beaten the Red Menace, and it was the Red Menace's turn to beat the Blue Marauder. Well, that kind of stuff happens at guard armories. I mean, once upon a time, I really did go to wrestling at the guard armory. And so MSNBC, early last week, dispatched crews to Welch to begin to build the set for this town hall meeting. Now, bear in mind, I mean, they didn't have space for an unlimited number of people. They invited people. It wasn't, you know, only for Democrats or only for Republicans or only for independents. It was for people who really wanted to be there and really wanted to talk about the issue, the poverty issues that face McDowell County. And yes, Bernie Sanders was going to be there, but Bernie's not running for anything in West Virginia. There's no election. There's no election Bernie's running for this year. And MSNBC was going to be there. And I think it would have been, that's the hint, would have been a pretty informative piece of journalism and citizen voices. Late Friday afternoon, evening, after everything was all in place, plane tickets had been bought, travel plans had been made, hotel rooms had been booked, cars had been rented. The state of West Virginia, via West Virginia National Guard Brigadier General Harrison Gilliam, made a phone call to MSNBC and said, "We're sorry. We've decided to cancel your little town hall there. You can't have it. You can't hold it." Why? Because we say so. Well, I mean, we've got an agreement. Yeah, well, the Brigadier General, the Lord High General, has declared that we got a rule here in West Virginia that says the guard armories can't be used for no political purposes. Oh, really? Yeah. Yep, we sure do. That's a rule we've got. It's just like a rule they got up to the DOD. No political activities at no political events at National Guard armories. Well, I guess that means there's not going to be a town hall. Damn right there's not. Well, okay then. There's only one problem. Even though the spokesperson for the West Virginia National Guard, a guy by the name of Larry Messina, once again, so the Charleston Gazette, they tried to reach the governor, Jim Justice. Jobs, jobs, jobs. He campaigned and campaigned and campaigned. Jobs, jobs, jobs. You know, when he wasn't telling his Kunta Kinte story. Jobs, jobs, jobs. And so you would think that an event that was going to talk about poverty issues, which is related to the absence of jobs, 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 would have actually been something that might have been, you know, beneficial. Call me crazy. But Jim Justice doesn't want any uppity Yankee outside agitators coming in down there in McDowell County and you know, showing the real filthy, dirty underbelly of the West Virginia coal industry. And so, lo and behold, the town hall got canceled. Here's where it gets fun. So if there's a rule, and it's promulgated both by the Federal Department of Defense and by the state of West Virginia, let's understand one thing. A government speaks only through its laws and its rulemaking. I mean, let's say Senator Thumbinbutt of the West Virginia legislature, good God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered, evangelical Republican, let's say he says, you know what? We got a rule here in West Virginia that we don't want no Homer sectionals here. Well, that's bullshit, because a government speaks only through its laws and its rulemaking. Anything else don't count. And so though they've cited this rule, and they've said it exists, to the best of my knowledge, and I have looked high and low, I assure you, they have yet to produce evidence of this rule. So then you have to go and you look for historic precedents to turn the thing on its ears. First thing I thought of was all the bean dinners that take place for the bug tussle Republican county committee and the Siler's Swamp Democratic Executive Committee at National Guard armories in places like West Virginia and a lot of other places too. Can't get much more political than that now, can you? No. So, there's that. And they've never been suppressed. They've never had to, well, I'm sorry, the Lord High General's declared that you can't have your ramps and bean dinner because we can't be having political events down to the armory. Uh-uh. And frankly, those ramps and bean dinners are too numerous to even try to quantify. And they're good, too. Damn. Spring ain't that far off. The little old ramps will be sticking their heads up through the... Well, it won't be snow. Well, I don't know. The way this winter's gone, by April, we may be 6 feet of the... But no, they're the first green thing that pokes its little head through the Appalachian soil at the end of the ferociousness of winter. And they're strong. And mercy sakes, I mean, they will... they're strong. But you saute them up and you have them with some good brown beans and cornbread. And why do I do this to myself? I haven't had food for a week. Well, I think that's probably why I'm doing this. Because goddamn, I'd crawl across ground glass to kiss the bumper of the truck that brought in that damn cornmeal for that cornbread. But ramps and beans and cornbread. Stop it. And they happen all the time. But then I got to thinking about some other things, because one of the arguments that I've made in the past, and it's not an argument, it's a fact, is that back in the year 2000, one of the reasons that we wound up getting the Reign of Error is because a little old pissant state like West Virginia, that was reliable as a Democratic bastion and voted for Democratic presidential candidates, decided to shoot itself in the foot, reload, and empty the chamber on the other foot in the process, and instead give our five pissant electoral votes to George W. Bush instead. It is a fact that had West Virginia simply voted the right way, Florida and the hanging Chads and the pregnant Chads and the Republican riot and the Miami-Dade vote counting wouldn't have mattered. Al Gore would have simply been the president. But the hillbillies screwed the pooch. Well, the reason I thought about that is because in October of the year 2000, there was a big hootenanny at the Beckley-Raleigh County National Guard Armory in which hero of freedom, Charlton Heston, came and told the assembled, credulous, mouth-breathers and knuckle-walkers, Al Gore's gonna get your guns, you damn dirty apes. And they bought it. And that's a big reason why this state went for Bush in 2000, Charlton Heston. Damn you, Ron in the far frozen north. When you're sitting down to your ramps and beans and cornbread, don't forget the chilled buttermilk, you bastard. So that happened, and it was a National Guard Army. By the time the 2004 election rolled around, I was on the air on terrestrial radio in Beckley, and it was July of 2004 when Dim Leader showed up in Beckley again at the Raleigh County National Guard Armory for an obviously political event, to wit, a great big goddamn rally for his reelection effort. 4 years later, candidate Barack Obama showed up. And then, and there's no way this ain't political, it may have been a funeral memorial service, but there ain't no way it ain't political, Barack Obama came back to the Raleigh County Armory for the memorial service for the 29 miners incinerated by Don Blankenship at the Upper Big Branch disaster. That was the one where Barack Obama actually stood up at the memorial service and repeated the advertising slogan of the West Virginia Coal Association. I'm here to tell you that coal keeps the lights on. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Agnes about had to chase me down in the yard over that one. I was fit to run rabbits. So I think we have a pretty solid basis, in including political events at the Coonskin National Guard Armory in Charleston. Yeah. So I thought, well, that must mean that new Department of Defense rule must be sometime after 2009. Well, okay. I mean, this is kind of like a process of elimination. It's sort of like some sort of political archaeology where you're trying to identify strata, layers of activity. Okay, so maybe the Federal Department of Defense put that rule in after 2009. Maybe that's something the Obama administration did. And wouldn't that be fucking ironic? Ha? Keep digging. It was May 2016 when New Jersey, the state of New Jersey, was all a titter because they were going to have their first campaign appearance by the one, the only, Donald J. Trump, candidate for the Republican presidential nomination. And they had it. And there were oodles of mouth-walking knuckle-breathers wearing their red Chinese-made MAGA hats all over that all over that New Jersey National Guard Armory. Ooh, Lordy, didn't they have a fine, fine old time? So at that point in time, I'm pretty well convinced that the archaeology experiment was a failure. Because the rule being cited by the Lord High General of the West Virginia National Guard would have to have been put in place by the Department of Defense, you know, the Pentagon, after May of 2016. And I feel fairly confident in saying that it was not. Now, here in about 24 minutes, if you tune in to All In with Chris Hayes, and just this once, I'll be okay if you leave the program to go and do it. If you tune in to Chris Hayes, you will still see Bernie Sanders. It's just that he and Chris will not be in McDowell County, because Chris Hayes and Bernie Sanders were effectively told by Jim Justice, jobs, jobs, jobs. You know, God made me Jim Justice and not Kunta Kinte for a reason. To, shall we say, not let the sun set on them in McDowell County. Now, you must understand that Jim Justice is not an independent actor any more than Brigadier Lord High General of the West Virginia National Guard Adjutant General's Office, Harrison Gilliam is. HB, they call him HB. They don't call him Harrison, they call him HB. Neither of those creatures are capable of independent action. HB was put in office in January of 2016 under the Tomlin administration. Jim Justice was inaugurated as governor of West Virginia just last month. Jobs, jobs, jobs! They are both tools. Like a hammer's a tool, or a cold chisel, or a screwdriver, or a staple gun, or a blackjack, or a swagger stick, or brass knuckles. They're tools. And of course, in order for tools to have any meaning, back to anthropology again, you got to have somebody capable of using them. That someone is, of course, Joe Manchin, because Joe Manchin owns Jim Justice. And Joe Manchin owns the moribund, totally rat-fucked rump of the West Virginia Democratic Party. The West Virginia Democratic Party that under Joe Manchin has turned into the political equivalent of the Washington Generals and has lost both houses of the legislature for the first time in 84 years, has lost the Secretary of State, has lost the Attorney General, has lost the Auditor, has lost everything except the Governor, Joe Manchin's creature, and the Treasurer, a guy who has his own political power base. I mean, when you put the pieces together that way, it's kind of hard for the puzzle not to have a big red arrow pointing at a picture of the smiling, smarmy mug of Baloney Joe Manchin. So the question then becomes, why didn't Joe Manchin want Bernie Sanders in West Virginia? And the answer can be found, in part, in the fact that once he had decided to come to McDowell County, his publisher then said, well, hey, Bernie, let's have a lecture book signing event in Charleston on the Sunday before, which they did. And thousands of people showed up to hear Bernie Sanders speak at the Municipal Auditorium in Charleston, West Virginia. Because the people of this state, like the people of so much of this country, are hungry, starving. Why does that keep coming up in my speech? For answers. They're desperate for them. Anyone who isn't completely obsessed with little precious little fetuses and where other people go potty, know that this state is in terrible, 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 terrible trouble. Like so much of the rest of this once great nation. And that the politics of incrementalism and the politics of the same old, and the politics of go along, get along, ain't going to cut it anymore. And so they lined up to go in and see Bernie. Before that, however, they showed up at the governor's mansion to protest and demand answers for why it was that free speech was suppressed ostensibly on the whim of an appointed general 2 days before the event was to take place. Because that's what it boils down to. This is a suppression of free speech. And the excuse used, well, we've got a rule that says can't be no political events at the Armory. I'll bet there is something along those lines. Because, see, the Pentagon has rules about people in uniform engaging in political action. For instance, those Navy SEALs who went driving down the goddamn road with their fucking Trump flag on the back of a government vehicle and got themselves in one shitstorm of hot water. Because we have a military that is not supposed to be politicized, even though it is. It's also not supposed to be proselytized, but it is. Recall the fact that we had an arms manufacturer who was sending rifles, manufacturing and sending rifles to Afghanistan with a goddamn Bible verse on the barrel. The more Christ-like to kill Muslim infidels with. But there's probably a rule that prevents Joe Bob Sisterfister from wearing his MAGA hat to weekend drills down to the Armory. On the other hand, however, political speech is the most highly protected form of speech in the United States. First Amendment case law from the Supreme Court makes that abundantly clear. And you suppress political speech at your peril. I mean, for heaven's sake, that's what Citizens United is about. We can't keep billionaires from pouring as much money into the political process as they want to because their billions of dollars are actually speech, and to forbid them to spend it on political messaging would be to quell their First Amendment free speech rights, and we cannot have a prior restraint like that on something as precious as political speech under the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. Amen. Hallelujah. Praise Jesus. And again, nobody was running for office and no one was preaching a political message. Unless you consider it a political message that the people of McDowell County need to stand up for themselves and demand that they be heard. I'll note along the way that their elected representative to the House of Representatives has not bothered to hold a town hall in McDowell County or anywhere else in his district. So what you have is a prior restraint act of suppression of political speech, if we can deem that political speech, that should be illegal as hell and should cost old HB, the Lord High General, his goddamn brass. And should cause outrage at jobs, Jim Justice. Because you can't have the poor people be getting all uppity and thinking that they's somebody that the money ought to listen to. Now, see, if Bernie Sanders had promised that he would go to McDowell County and talk about the wondrous, wondrous, miraculous wonders of coal, well, shit, nobody would have lifted a finger. And if some Republican outfit wants to have a set to at the armory to talk about the precious little fetuses and how they can be baby raped by a drag queen in the potty, well, we're going to have that meeting here in West Virginia. Oh, sweet Jesus, yes, because that's not politics. Why, that's just good God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing Christianity. And there ain't no rule, again, being a Christian in the guard armory. Sons of bitches. Now, I've probably been a little bit more coarse in this than Bernie or Chris will be, because they are well-heeled and sane and properly behaved. But son of a bitch! I can honestly say I never thought I'd live to see the day. Apparently West Virginia is some sort of hybrid of a military dictatorship. I mean, what kind... The agreement to use that armory had been in place for quite a long while, a month or so. What kind of chain of command does the West Virginia National Guard have that it takes a rental agreement for the McDowell County Armory a sure enough slap month to get from Welch to Charleston? What? Did the lieutenant have to walk? Damnation! You can walk from Welch to Charleston in a good 5 days. Did he get lost? Was it lost in the hubbub of the big upcoming invasion of Kentucky and the war on coal? If it takes that long to get to the Lord High General, we got bigger problems than I thought. Then again, I live in a state that can't even remove snow from the roads anymore. So I just wanted to share that all with you. Happy news, thanks to Dave and to Kitty. We have met Randy's challenge. So we got $300 to go. And it's actually $200 now. Because Joan just wrote in from Talibandiana and said, I'll be sending $100 later tonight. in appreciation of your program and the fact that I missed you and the rest of the family so very much. Subject line is, thank X, you're back. Thank you, Joan. Thank you. But she's doubling down. Like I said, we're kind of scarce of subscribers this time of the month. And Joan says, I will also offer a $50 challenge for 3 or more new subscribers by program time tomorrow. Please let me know. So Joan will bump 3 new subscriptions on their first month. And we're talking about a 10 bucks subscription. By 50 bucks. Thank you, Joan. Thank you so very much. I hope people will take Joan up on that. Thank you. Meanwhile, from Steve, a member of the Fraternity of Steve, right now solar energy is contributing less than 2% of global needs. That is absolutely true. This is an amazing figure, considering that I've read somewhere that utilizing only 0.02% of available solar energy would take care of the entire planet's needs. This is a small area of all the sunlight that hits the Mojave Desert. There is. Around Las Vegas every single day, and currently we don't have very far to go before improvements in storage technology can easily solve the problems of power generation and transmission. It's just a matter of infrastructure. And putting truckloads of people to work. The closer you get to the poles, of course, the harder it is to get that sunlight, but near the equator, you kind of see where this is going, I guess. If we really lived in a global economy instead of a rapacious capitalist system of misery and death, countries on the equator would suddenly be rich, and their abundance of sunlight would be sold on an open market to the darker, colder, not quite so rich, way too white people countries. Right, says Steve. Wrong. Because what is killing us more than the fossil fuel being burned today is the fossil fuel the capitalist pigs know is still in the ground. Oh well, I guess Mexico isn't going to be selling any Aztec sunlight anytime soon, much less paying for that goddamn wall. By the way, for those too busy watching TV to vote, why not give up your citizenship too? Because you pretty much have, and you damn sure can't jeer or cheer your favorite politician. Regards, Steve in China. I think that's one of the most frustrating things about all of this. This isn't like a disease that we have no idea how to cure and is running pandemic around the planet. No, in fact, this is the lead-in to, remember the old Lee Majors vehicle, the $6 million man? And how you had to watch him as an astronaut, you know, it just blow up landing and get the, and they, you know, I guess they were like, they scraped little pieces of him out of the, you know. And then you hear the words, we can rebuild him. We have the technology. Well, we do. We need some, as Steve notes, we need some innovation in storage and transmission. That's simply a matter of figuring out how to push the electrons around. It's not a matter of trying to figure out what the equation for wattage or voltage or amperage is. Or resistance. We know those things. And with something approaching a Manhattan Project for renewable energy, as Paul from Parts Unknown pointed out, we could have massive solar stations in place in the 2020s, and that's only the beginning of the 2020s is only 3 years away. But we don't. It's kind of like I could sit down to a 7-course meal. But I can't. Because I've got a rotten gut that doesn't want to cooperate. Well, in this analogy, think of my rotten gut as the oil industry and the coal industry and the natural gas industry. And no matter how badly I yearn for something as simple as a salad with a little oil and vinegar on it. I can't eat it because my gut will not cooperate. And until such time as the people of this country stand up and tell the fossil fuel industry to go Trump itself, it's going to be a long, hard climb. Oh, and by the way, 5 minutes before the hour, a new word, a new hashtag. I started following the alternate first lady account on Twitter. And whoever she is, she's funny as hell. Oh my God. She types in what reads like a bad Eastern European accent. And at one point she noted, Donald is all time doing his tweeting while he is in bathroom. Is disgusting. I call it twooping. He's tweeting while pooping, thus twooping. So that's the hashtag, twooping, T-W-O-O-P-I-N-G, twooping. I laughed so hard when I first read that I really did hurt myself. Note coming from Don in Central PA, subject line, Jim Justice. My apologies for tuning in a little late this evening. I heard you mention Jim Justice. I'm sorry, but every time I hear Jim Justice, I think of a comic book hero, Jim Justice, savior of coal. Wait a minute, that deserves... Yeah. Jim Justice, savior of coal! Is that kind of what it sounds like inside your mind, Don? Because it's what it sounds like inside mine. Wearing a black Spider-Man type suit with eyes that look like glowing coal, fighting the evildoers from the EPA and other government agencies trying to kill the coal industry. Jobs, jobs, jobs! That's what he says when he springs into action. Jobs, jobs, jobs. And he became the superhero that he is when he emerged after falling into a coal filth impoundment of some several billion gallons, and came out with his superpowers to make little babies develop fucking asthma from just trying to breathe air. Good one, Don. Good one. Wait a minute. Mm-hmm. So that's just the beginning. But you're like me. I mean, I haven't been able to get behind the microphone and sort of chapter and verse it every night. But goddamn. I mean, some dude at Mar-a-Lago just happened to send out a photograph of the guy with the nuclear football and gave his name. Yeah, I wish I was joking. Hey, let's check in with Scott and Punky, shall we? Hey, Scott.
Hey, Bob. Welcome back.
Hi, Punky.
Punky says hi. Sorry you're feeling poorly and that your gut will not cooperate.
It's a bitch, I promise.
I'm sure. I will send you all of the healing energy that I can possibly muster.
Well, I appreciate it. And a little mustard wouldn't hurt either.
Yeah. Some of that
relish.
And what is it? Kroger brand Dijon, is that the one that you
I got a bottle of it right here.
There you
Private
go.
Selection French recipe Dijon mustard crafted with finely ground mustard seeds.
Yeah, I've got mustard on my list for the next time I go to the grocery store, so I will.
Well, if you're at Ralph's, look for that stuff. It's kind of spicy. It'll open up your sinuses.
Well, that's all right. My sinuses could use all the help they can get. Okay, this will be kind of a quickie because I don't have anything much on my mind, strangely enough. But I've got a couple of TV viewing tips for the fun lovers and truth seekers. One of them was brought to mind earlier when you were talking with Sparky about the Oroville Dam. And in 2011, one of the nieces or granddaughters or somebody connected to Jerry Brown's father, Governor Jerry Brown's father, Pat Brown, who was governor here in the late 50s and into the early 60s, she did a documentary called California State of Mind, The Legacy of Pat Brown. And for those of you who have Netflix, it's available on there for streaming. It's quite a good interview. It's about 90 minutes. And when you're talking about the dam, a lot of people who are not from around here or don't know much about California don't realize how much we depend on being creative when it comes to providing water for what is essentially a desert, a lot of the state. And Pat Brown and the legislature back in those days knew that that was going to be the key to making California a truly golden state. And they set about, with the people's support and enthusiasm, putting together a water system which should be up among the wonders of the world. And I don't know, I believe the Oroville Dam is recent enough to where it would have been part of that overall project. It's been a while since I saw the documentary, but it's worth your time if you have Netflix, California State of Mind, The Legacy of Pat Brown. And just now you were talking in response to one of the emailers regarding the switchover from fossil fuel to renewable energy, and the sticking point seems to be batteries and storage. And also, to a lesser extent, the grid being an old school grid when we need a new school grid. A couple of weeks ago on PBS, there was an episode of Nova called Search for the Super Battery, which was quite good. And it goes into some of the technology that's being developed to solve that issue in terms of battery and storage concerns. And that's on online at pbs.org, I guess it is. Nova, the search for the super battery.
Oh, good, because I will go in search of that, because in the course of the last week, Agnes and I have watched everything we could find that was interesting.
Yeah, I know how that works.
It's brutal. But I want to offer a caveat to that, Scott.
All right.
And this isn't me being, you know, Bob Kincaid, little ray of sunshine or anything.
No phone call to you would be complete without a caveat of one sort or another. So I sit here.
You know, I like my caveat on little toast points, maybe with some chopped onions and sour cream and maybe some capers. Oh, God damn it.
And a tiny dab of Ralph's brand, Kroger brand.
You're goddamn right. we've got to find a better way to store and a better way to transfer. Because we've got to find a better way, we've got to find a way to not burn any more of this shit. And the only reason that the hydrocarbon industry, be it coal, oil, or gas, wants to spend the money to do it is to make more money. In other words, it is driven by avarice. Are we in agreement?
Oh, sure.
But they have accomplices. And from almost the beginning of electricity, they have had accomplices. There are things for which we absolutely must have electricity. And I think you could tuck those nicely into Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You know, food, shelter. And so, in a place where global climate change has driven temperatures into the three digits, And people in fragile health conditions, for instance, will die without appropriate heat or cooling. That's worth spending electricity on. It's worth spending the electricity needed to manufacture the things that we need for renewable energy infrastructure. Agreed?
Yeah.
Okay. You know what we don't need? Electric can openers. And what I mean by this is that energy efficiency is not just a matter of sealing, making sure your windows are sealed up real good and you've got your house insulated nice and snug, or building a house with a broad southern exposure to take in both natural light and heat, because that natural heat can be a real bitch in the summer. But it's about relearning how to be us. It's about going and I'm guilty, okay? I'm not saying, oh, be like Bob. No. No. You go to Wally World, you can buy a perfectly serviceable Chinese-made electric knife, you know, for slicing into your, for making those really lovely paper thin slices of your eye of round roast that you've done in the oven with a salt dough crust.
You're torturing yourself, Bob. You're talking about food again.
I did it again. Well, it's pretty obvious, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
I can taste it.
And in your position, I would probably be doing the exact same thing.
But the thing is, that can all be equally well accomplished by learning the lost art of proper knife maintenance and having a good carbon steel knife and learning how to hone it and whet it so that it's at a razor's edge. And then it does the same job equally well. You know, the next time I turn on a documentary about some sushi chef... That's one of the things I've done while I haven't been eating. I think I've watched every episode Tony Bourdain did on his CNN version of his program.
Oh yeah.
I have never seen a master sushi chef take a Walmart home electric knife to a lovely loin of tuna. Damn, that tuna'd be good too. A little soy sauce, some fresh wasabi. Oh, stop it. But I mean, you see what I'm getting at. I mean,
yeah, well,
nobody's life is made manifestly better by an electric can opener.
Well, when you mentioned the electric can opener in terms of useless electricity gobbling devices, supposedly labor saving devices, the first energy hog that came to mind that virtually everyone within the sound of my voice has, maybe several of in their very own homes, are these instant-on televisions. Now, when I was growing up, way back in the scintillating 60s, late 50s into the 60s, as a mere prat of a child, you would turn on the TV, and a period of maybe 20 or 30 seconds would elapse as the screen went from black to whatever the over-the-air picture was, okay? And then when you turned off the TV, the picture would shrink onto itself down to a little white dot that would linger.
I remember the dot.
For a few moments and then disappear. And why you don't see the little white dot anymore is because even when your TV, your modern TV, is turned off, it's not really off. It's on standby. It's sucking up electricity. And if you multiply the number of TVs in a given household by the number of households, that's a shit pot of energy that's being sucked up and used simply because people don't have patience enough to wait 25 seconds for the picture to appear on their goddamn television. You know?
Oh, I know. I really do. Because, you know, over the course of a lifetime, those seconds you're waiting eagerly for that picture to come on, they turn into hours.
Yeah.
And the same thing with computers. We all get sick of watching the boot up. And let me add, you know, there's the trickle effect, too. Most people leave their charger plugged in for their phone.
I do, and
so
I probably
when it's time,
shouldn't,
when
but
it's
I
time
do.
To, when it's time to put the charger, the phone on the charger, you just plug the, in the, and, you know, you charge the phone. But even when it's not connected to the phone, that little wart, that little brick, is still consuming power. And over the course of a year, it can mount up to $4 or $5. But it's also consuming power that we don't have to consume, but we consume because lazy, because spoiled. In the era, I mean, you talk about the 60s, I mean, In the era of early electricity here in this neck of the woods, electricity first came into homes here by way of Delco batteries. And because one was using electricity by battery, one did not use it frivolously.
How the hell did you charge the Delco battery?
Well, you didn't. When the Delco battery ran down, you took it to town, and you swapped it out for a new Delco battery.
Oh, okay.
If it wasn't renewable and sustainable, it was damn sure recyclable. And so the Delco battery you were using might be the Delco battery that the superintendent of the mines used in his house last week.
Now, when you say Delco battery, do you mean the old fashioned automotive batteries with the little removable caps, and you would add water?
No, these were Delco DC batteries for home use.
Huh, okay.
It wasn't repurposed. I mean, this was how electricity was provided in the era before alternating current distributed grid construction. And it was during the New Deal that Franklin Roosevelt heard the cries and pleas of people, you know, like my family back then. I mean, this is way before me, of course, way before you, who said, we sure would like to have some of that flip the switch electricity. But all the power companies said, you know, it's not worth it for us to string wire all the way out to you hillbillies. It's not economically feasible.
Well, yeah.
So FDR heard that and he said, okay, well, I understand. So we're going to pass something called the Rural Electrification Act, the REA. And the federal government is going to go into the electricity business. And we're going to provide electricity to these people that you don't think are worth it to you from a capitalist standpoint to provide electricity to. And all of a sudden the power companies looked up and went, you are? We are. Well, that ain't fair. That's competing against us. Well, no, we're not competing against you. You don't want to do business with them. Well, we do now. What do you say you create your Rural Electrification Act and put a bunch of money in it and give us the money and we'll provide them the power? Well, okay then. And so the power of the federal government was used to extend electricity to people who had never had it before, and the Delco batteries went away.
Which is probably why I don't recall hearing about them, because they're of another era. I mean, I would never have thought that that's what people did.
I mean, that was the first electricity in these parts. And generations later, they thought they might try the same thing with the internet. So the U.S. Department of Agriculture had a grant program whereby they would give horse-gagging amounts of money to state governments to provide internet infrastructure for underserved areas. West Virginia got some $20 million because we are significantly underserved. I mean, this program is coming to you now through a Frontier Communications connection that delivers 10 down and 1 up. That's it. And so Joe Manchin got that $20 million check from the government, went, here, let me endorse this. Joe, that's a J-O-E Manchin. And then reached out to his fine, fine friends at Verizon and said, I think this is yours. And instead of using it on building badly needed internet infrastructure, he gave it to Verizon. And Verizon said, well, thanks, Joe. Oh, by the way, did we tell you that we're leaving town? Because we are. Yeah, we're going to leave town, and we're going and another little company called Frontier has bought in. And they're not going to have nearly as many union workers and probably a lot shittier service. But thanks for the 20 mil, Joe.
Well,
and that really happened.
When you were talking about the Roosevelt's plan to electrify these rural areas that the commercial energy companies deemed not worth serving, okay, that was the same thing with the Bell system back in a comparable era. The cost of stringing telephone line out to these far-flung places in the mountains and across the plains was not worth it to Ma Bell, which is what caused once upon a time in this country, there used to be a real big bunch of independent telephone companies, which eventually were tied into the Bell system infrastructure, but they served these places that Ma Bell decided were not feasible economically to serve. And the modern, like you say, the modern version of rural electrification is the lack of the internet in a lot of places in this country where, you know, there are places, I'm sure, that still operate with a dial-up service.
Our buddy Devin lives in the quiet zone of West Virginia. And so, you know, brutally expensive satellite internet.
It's
metered during peak hours, just like long distance phone calls used to be. I mean, you mentioned these little rural phone companies. One of the really crappy internet experiences we've had here was with a cable company called Shentel, which stands for Shenandoah Telephone. Now, south of the New River, people have Suddenlink communications. Over here where I am, we get Shentel. And Shentel is so bad that they cannot even maintain their own infrastructure. So, you know, like, I don't know if you've ever tuned into it, but, you know, we've got a 24/7 stream that goes. And it goes out sometimes, even with the connection we have here, but it's been much more steady and reliable than with Shentel. There were nights I couldn't even get the 64 kbps upstream to get up to the server with those people. And yet at the same time, they were promising and billing me for 10 megabytes per second up. And they couldn't even deliver 64 kbps. And it's because we've treated the internet as a Wild West sort of affair. But the internet is now the primary delivery system for just about everything, which kind of goes back to our original conversation. Do we really need our coffee pot connected to the internet?
No, I don't even have a coffee pot. I know it's a travesty, but years ago, 20, 25 years ago, Paul Harvey sold me a Bun coffee maker, which was probably the best coffee maker I ever had. And it's another example of the instant on technology.
Yeah, you don't want to sit around waiting for that coffee to drip through, damn it.
No, you can't wait 2.5-3 minutes for a fresh cup of coffee, boys and girls. You've got to buy the Bun coffee maker. And how the Bun coffee maker worked was there was always a reservoir of water in the thing, and it was always on, already heated, so that when you poured the new container of water in, the already hot water would immediately begin to perk through and brew your coffee, and you'd have a fresh hot pot of coffee inside of a minute or thereabouts.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, I mean, my parents had one too, and every now and then you'd hear it go as the element kicked on and reboiled the water.
Yeah, it used to make some really unearthly noises. And on a dark, stormy night when you lived alone and you knew that there was nobody else around, you'd hear some sort of unearthly noise emanating from the kitchen. And before you remembered what was causing it, you'd kind of freak out a little bit, or at least I would. But I freak out. In those days, I used to freak out rather easily. But
and we have eventually opted for the Keurig approach. You know, where you buy the brutally expensive little plastic ecological nightmare cups.
Oh, yes, yes.
But you can also buy little reusable cups that you can use with regular coffee. And so the amount of coffee wasted, because, you know, you're always pouring some of the coffee down the drain, assuming that you're not using it for dirty gravy. Damn it! It's cost effective that way. And you still have this, but you know, it's that still, you know, it's always on and the water's always hot. But you know, the Internet of Things with refrigerators tied into the internet and coffee pots tied into the internet and dishwashers tied into the internet and, you know, if I tried that here with the state of the bandwidth here, I'd never get a program on the air because all my appliances would be, you know, watching coffee pot porn.
Yeah. I have found personally that there are limits. I mean, I will buy into technology up to a point, but there comes a point where it just starts to get ridiculous. I don't want my refrigerator. I don't want my refrigerator to be more tied in to the state of things than I am, you know. And maybe that's because of the era I grew up in my day. And I'm not that old. I really am not.
Now, I don't want to get to that point where I go to get a cup of coffee and the coffee pot screen says, "Jesus, did you see what Trump did?"
Well, not only that, but I've seen 2001: A Space Odyssey. I don't want to have an ongoing argument for my life support.
I'm sorry,
Dave.
It's decaf. I'm sorry, Scott. It's decaf today.
You know, but the thing is, it's like my version of the internet growing up in the 60s was the World Book Encyclopedia. Okay. And, you know, my younger brother, the fascist, and I talk about how different things would have been had we grown up in this current era, in terms of having all manner of information, not to mention porn, at our fingertips instantly, you know, we would have probably been much better students. Well, no probably about it. We would have been much better students. You know, God, who remembers typing term papers with those goddamn footnotes and those margins?
I hated footnotes. I hated them. Because just allowing for them, or, I mean, if I had a professor that wanted footnotes instead of endnotes, yeah, fuck it, I'm out of this class.
Yeah. Well, my last 2 years in high school, junior and senior years, were the only years that I attended public schools of any sort. And I had the for some reason, I forget now what it was, because they certainly weren't what you call easy courses. I took 2 years of graphic arts in my junior and senior year at the public high schools that I went to those last 2 years. And I learned all manner of printing, offset, letterpress, typesetting, just all manner of things connected with printing, but also photography, silk screening, linoleum block carving to do block art. I mean, all manner of stuff that served me well, that involved not only molten lead, but big rooms full of noisy, difficult to maintain, smelly, chemical-laden equipment. And now, you know, 20 years after that, and we're talking about the early 70s, 20 years later, you could duplicate the effects of all of that old-school technology with a not a laptop, but a desktop computer and a high-quality laser printer. You know? So.
Well, exactly. And by the way, just as a caveat, Ron in the far frozen north points out, the Internet of Things represents the biggest single cybersecurity threat out there. Too many conflicting standards, too many amateurs writing code, and too many entrepreneurs expecting to get rich quickly. And 80% of the chips are fabbed in China or Taiwan. China!
Yeah, well, that's a nightmare waiting to happen. And we see examples of that thing going south in a fat hurry every day now. I mean, the fact that banking is so computerized ought to scare the fluorescent piss out of everybody, man, woman, and child among us. Like, there was a thing on the news the other night about a guy, I believe he was in Turkey, who figured out a way to hack virtually every banking system in the known world, and then he hired a bunch of criminals to, on a given day, go to the ATMs, and he override the payout limit. I mean, he really thought this through and ended up ripping off the banks to the tune of dozens of millions of dollars. All because he knew how to do stuff on the system as it currently was to rip it off.
That's a variation on the plot to Office Space.
I don't know that.
Mike Judge, before Idiocracy. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, oh, by the way, just apropos of nothing, the Senate has just voted in the last half hour or so to confirm Steve Mnuchin as Secretary of the Treasury. Naturally, my senator, Joe Manchin, said, well, hell yeah! I mean, granted, he's a ripoff artist, and he created a foreclosure mill and called it One West Bank. But you know what? West Virginians don't have any savings to steal anyway, so let him in.
No, which agency head will he be?
Treasury.
Treasury, okay. I confused
yeah,
him
a,
with...
Yeah, a former Goldman Sachs foreclosure baron is in charge of the Treasury.
How's that draining the swamp thing working out?
Well,
there,
like
well.
I said, there's a Mnuchin stuck in the drain.
Jesus.
I know.
See, this is why I wonder about this whole notion of resist. Because all the marches and all the resistance, so far, those who have, for whom there has been an opportunity for the Senate to vote, so far, none of the nominees have gone down in flames. You've got your Betsy DeVos. You've got your, well, name them. I mean, we already know. We've got Sessions as Attorney General. We've got, just all of them. As far as I know, none of them have met the fate that we hoped for. So
well,
that makes me
no,
wonder.
But I mean, I was the one preaching a little bit of sanity about all this in the first place, Scott. Because when it comes to cabinet nominees, you're dealing with a hydra. Even if we'd stopped Sessions, we could have gotten Kris Kobach.
Yeah.
Okay. You stop Betsy DeVos, there's somebody worse behind Betsy DeVos.
And I think there's a lesson here, and the lesson is the time to resist is not now, trying to mop up this fucking mess. The time to resist was back during the goddamn primaries and into the general election season.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, if anybody shows up at any of these marches, I don't know. Maybe there should be a booth. You know, you don't ask them, did you vote Democrat? Did you vote? Did you vote Bernie? Did you vote? You don't ask that. Just ask them, did you vote? And they go, well, no. Go the fuck home.
Well,
you're the problem.
Yeah. And God knows, if you play back some of the shows during the primary season and the general election, I beat my gums half to death and my brains got beaten half out of my head trying to get this across to people. And you did too. To what avail? It was like farting against thunder.
I'm not going to say, well, you know, I mean, yeah, stay home. Because the way you energize for 2018 is now. You prepare for midterms immediately after the general.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the time to be finding candidates to run in a primary that's the registration for which will close 11 months from now.
Yeah, and not 10 and a half months. Not to get food back into the conversation, but this is the time to get your ducks lined up in the proverbial row.
Oh, duck.
Oh, a little Peking duck. That reminds me of the lady that walked into the butcher store and asked the butcher for a Long Island duck. And the butcher handed the lady the duck, and it didn't look right, so she took her index finger and stuck it up the duck's ass and pulled it out and smelled it and said, wait a minute, this is not a Long Island duck, butcher. This is a Nebraska duck. Bring me a Long Island duck. So the butcher goes back and brings out another duck, and it still doesn't look right, so she takes her finger, sticks it in the duck's ass, pulls it out, sniffs it, and says, ah, this is a New Jersey duck. I asked for a Long Island duck. Bring me a Long Island duck. So the butcher goes back and brings her out another duck, and it looks right, but just to be sure, she puts her finger in, does the sniff test, says, now this is a Long Island duck. Wrap it up. And she pays the butcher, and she gets about halfway to the door, and she turns around and walks back to the counter and says, butcher, you must be new here. Where are you from? Whereupon the butcher pulled down his drawers, bent over and said, lady, you tell me.
You tell me. I was waiting. I was.
Jesus. Well, listen, I said at the outset this would be a short call, and it turned out not to be.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be.
I'll just go ahead and free up the line. But before I go, PBS website, search for the super battery, and Netflix, California State of Mind, The Legacy of Pat Brown. Two good shows to check out in your ersatz rubberized free time.
Indeed. Scott, you and Punky have a lovely evening. Don't forget the mustard when you go to Ralph's.
I will not, and I hope you're feeling better soon and eating healthily as a horse.
Well, I do too. I do too. Frankly, horse feed would be fine right now. Big bowl of oats would be lovely. Take care, Scott.
Okay, see ya.
Bye now. The inimitable Scott and Punky down San Diego way. And, oh my God, could it be? It appears to be. Is it? Hey, it's Thomas. Hey, Thomas.
How goes things?
Things go.
I hope so. In the land of Trumplandia, Trumptopia, as I like to call it, because, you know, it's everyone's utopia except, well, his or ours. Not quite sure whose. But the reason I wanted to call was I wanted to thank you. I did an article for RepublicanDirtyTricks.com today about the West Virginia town hall, and you were kind enough to quickly and early in the morning provide me a quote for it.
Wasn't that early?
So, well, for me, it's early. you provided a quote, and it is up on the blog. So if any, a lot of it was from the Sanders quote was from his statement in the Washington Post, where I found the initial article. But the quote was yours, and I want to go back to that a little bit because I talk about this on my show a lot, and I know you do, being in West Virginia, about poverty and how the United States is run. And I did a story a while back about this right-wing tool who got really upset about the universal basic income, something that would be a complete pipe dream in the United States. but would help millions of people, and in fact everyone, including the rich, because you don't always end up rich. Sometimes you fall hard on your luck and hard on your ass. And if there was a, say, $1,500 or $2,000 a month universal basic income that taxes were paid into, I think that would help struggling economies like the one Bernie wanted to talk to, and help struggling states and the Rust Belt get back on its feet while fighting for dear life. And I'd like your thoughts on a UBI.
The last person to talk about a livable wage instead of a minimum wage in the United States and get away with it was Richard M. Nixon. That's fact. After that, it was never mentioned again, or not meaningfully. Somewhere along the line, unless we're just going to go the way of the Malthusians and the Georgia Guidestones and that shit, because of the changing nature of the meaning of work, we're going to have to figure out what income means and what work means. And, you know, the people who are making lots of money are not going to like the idea of people who don't do what they consider to be meaningful work making any money at all. Because, you know, they got theirs, goddammit, by hard work. You know, not by operation of regulations or privilege or anything like that. So it's going to be a tough sell. But, you know, somewhere off in the future, there is a drastic change. There's going to be probably a drastic change in population. I think, who is it? Stephen Hawking says the computers are going to eat us if we don't get off this planet.
Yeah.
You know, one of the central tenets of Frank Herbert's Dune is that in the dim and distant past, there was a war, and out of that came a rule, thou shalt not make a machine in the image of the human mind. And that's why you get, I don't know if you've read Dune or not, that's why you get things like Mentats.
No, unfortunately,
but
I
it's,
haven't.
From the rise of sedentary agricultural societies,
yeah,
it doesn't take long before some medium of exchange comes into place. Because let's say you're sitting there working by the sweat of your brow, raising your field of barley, and you have to give X amount of it to Hammurabi, the great king, so that they won't come and cut your head off. Well, when you give that to Hammurabi, Hammurabi has to give you something back saying that you paid your due so that when the headloppers come around, you can say, oh, no, don't lop my head. I paid. And that's actually the origins of writing, Thomas. The origins of literacy are in accounting. The first manifestations of literacy are in keeping track of who gave how much barley to the king so they wouldn't lop his head off.
Oh, wow.
And that, in turn, leads to a situation in which it's a lot simpler to carry around a chit that means X bushels of barley than it is to carry all those bushels of barley with you. And so you take this technological leap in literacy, and the whole of what we understand of a human civilization goes from there. And that, you know, that ties into this this idea. There's a Marxist element to what you're talking about, in that, you know, communism says that we're going to take care of everybody. And from those according to their means to those according to their need. And ultimately the goal is to have a perfectly equal society. Well, within in the pre-capitalist and the rising capitalist societies, you know, you still have things like subsistence farming. My ancestors, up until two generations ago, were still subsistence farmers on one part of my family. They raised their farm goods, they took them to market, they sold them, and with the money that they got that they didn't have to spend on next year's crop, they used that to buy things they could not make at home. I have ledger books from 1905.
Oh, wow.
Showing what the community came in and bought. And they would buy on credit until the crops came in and they sold them, and then they'd come in and settle up their tab. And so, in a way, everybody was in it together. The shopkeeper had as much at stake in the farmer getting his goods to market as the farmer himself did in many ways. And what they did is they came in and they bought bolts of cloth so mama could make their clothes. They bought jars because canning of, you know, fruits and vegetables and meat was invented somewhere around 1840. And it completely, it's one of those things we don't think about that completely changed the dynamic of human existence in many ways. So they bought jars and lids and rings. Or they bought jars with the snap down. It, you know.
Yeah.
They bought shotgun shells. They bought bullets. Not because they were freedom protectors, but because they were eating the deer that were in the forest to supplant, augment the hogs that they would usually raise for meat. And squirrels, they'd kill squirrels and that sort of thing. And shoot varmints. And they bought sugar. Because unless one had enough land to dedicate to a field of sorghum, you couldn't make your own sugar because it's a tropical product, except for the sugar beets, not. But nobody, you know, it's an intensive process turning a sugar beet into sugar. And so, you know, a general store, that's what they carried. They would carry cloth. They would carry shotgun shells. They would carry paper, pencils. And that subsistence economy does not mean that they were living like hell. It meant that they were actually living fairly well. They were living as comfortably as a human being could at that period in time. And in many cases, rural subsistence farmers actually lived better than their urban counterparts. And they had a basic income as long as they could stay healthy. And looking toward the future, and I'm no futurist.
Sure.
I get really confused really easily. It seems to me that in the modern age of the internet, with things like potential for wind and solar power,
yeah,
we could, in a place like West Virginia, I mean, look, the problem with McDowell County, where Bernie was going, is that there are no obvious solutions. You'd have to go there to understand, but everything in McDowell County is either uphill or down. And the only flat spaces are the narrow places by streams and the places where coal companies have blown the tops off mountains. And you can't do anything with those because they're toxic. But a lot of people came up out of there once upon a time from the same subsistence economy that I just described to you. Work a little plot of ground, get it to market. And nobody was rich, but you weren't necessarily poor either. You were just what there was there. But you take the internet and renewable energy, sustainable energy,
mm-hmm.
and you take some slightly more evolved farming techniques. And that kind of thing can flourish again. But, you know, who wants to be a farmer? Dirty work. Hard work. You know, when you're in the season, man, you are up at dawn or before dawn and you're down with the sun. And then winter, winter's cold, but it's also, you know, that's when you do all your harness mending and so forth. It's not that crazy to contemplate. But I think the future is decentralization of both energy and, to a certain extent, in a rural place like West Virginia, we don't need a Walmart every 15 miles. And God knows down there, there isn't. I mean, get on Google Earth later and look up, just type in Welch, West Virginia.
Okay.
And look at the lay of the land there.
Yeah. I had a family that grew up in Morgantown, West Virginia. So, and my
yeah,
uncle...
See, okay, not to be mean or anything, Thomas. West Virginia. Saying, but I had somebody grow up in Morgantown when I'm talking about McDowell County.
Oh yeah, and I was
no. That's like me talking about Cairo and having somebody say, "Well, I knew somebody who grew up in Cape Town."
Yeah, no, I was going to kind of get there. That it's totally different. It would be a totally different experience, and probably even I'd go so far as to say a culture shock, if I'm not mistaken, and I don't think I am. And that's why I think the whole thing with Bernie was so important, and that's why I think they canceled it, because it was that important, and it would shine a light on what is really going on. And God forbid, it doesn't take a genius to figure out they don't want that to happen. You know, they'd rather it
right.
remain a mystery like an X-File, you know. Which is sad.
Well, you know, you can't have people coming in and telling the rubes that there's a better way, or that there's any, because like I said, if Bernie was going to come in and sing the praises of coal, this issue would never have arisen. And see, the other problem is that Bernie, as an independent, is a better Democrat than Jim Justice, an alleged Democrat, will ever be. Because for his entire goddamn miserable, godforsaken, billionaire-ass life, Jim Justice was a Republican. Until shortly before the time to file for the governor's race, at which point he had a road to Damascus moment, the sun shone, his eyes opened, and he became a Democrat. Hallelujah. FDR. See how it works?
Oh, yeah.
And the thing is, if they're not careful, people may wise up on their own. And if they wise up on their own, well, they may not let Jim Justice and the West Virginia legislature make coal great again. And then where will we be?
No, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, so you can see the problem.
So it's a back to the double-edged sword, ironically enough. But I want to thank you for, one, the quote, and two, this conversation, because you're one of the few who realistically has it every night on the radio in different forms. But it's realistic, and it brings home what is needed when you or I, as progressives, want to see everybody equal and have social justice. And that's just...
Well, careful there. I don't necessarily want to see everybody equal. Everybody can never be equal.
Well, fair.
But I want to see people have equal opportunity and equal rights under the law. Because... If you're at the starting line of a race, and some people are standing there with fancy new track shoes on and the best running gear and little skimpy light clothing and things that'll help them get down the course. And they're standing next to somebody with one foot in a bucket, a blindfold on, wearing medieval goddamned armor. Well, we kind of know who's going to win the race now, don't we?
Yeah.
Not absolutely. The guy with one foot in a bucket, blindfolded, wearing medieval armor.
Yep.
Well, that's equality of opportunity. Give everybody the running shoes. Put everybody in the same kind of, you know, and then let them run the race.
Yeah.
And natural ability in any area will out, you know, natural ability, talent, training, skill. You know, these things matter. You know, I would not be worth a damn as an auto mechanic. And that's why I'm not one. But by the same token, the best auto mechanic in the world might not be worth a, you know, as a computer programmer. And the thing is, we need everybody, and there's room for everybody. But the question is how we treat them. I mean, this thing that we've been witnessing over the last few days, and we jokingly refer to Bush as the reign of error. This truly is, for a whole lot of millions of people, Thomas, what's going on around us now is the reign of terror. You've got children being separated from their parents. Oh well.
Yeah.
And you know, I value labor. I could not on my best day pick strawberries for a living. And so I respect the people who can. And because I respect the people who can, I want them paid a fair wage for a fair day's work. But that seems to be a hurdle that we can't quite get across without tripping and falling on our funny little faces. And that's a damn shame. And it's a problem that has to be sorted out. Education is the other big piece of the puzzle. You know that starting line of the race we were talking about with the armor and the guy in the track shoes?
Yeah,
well,
absolutely.
You can use that analogy with education too.
Yeah.
If you've got an underfunded school that gets underfunded because of the color of the skin of the children who go there, those are the kids with one foot in a bucket, a blindfold around their eyes, wearing medieval armor at the starting line. And it's and again, like the energy infrastructure, it's not like trying to invent something that'll prevent a catastrophe. It's just a matter of doing the right thing. Charter schools ain't the answer, because charter schools are mostly a money-sucking boondoggle. And that's where the equality part of the puzzle comes in that you were talking about. Equal access to information and education. What happens when a kid in the Mississippi Delta can get as high quality an education as a kid in the public schools of Massachusetts? What happens to Mississippi if that becomes the case? Well, it's never going to happen in Mississippi because the powers that be in Mississippi don't want that to happen, because they want a serf class. They want peonage. Because if you've got well-educated young black kids and poor whites, well, the people with power view it as a zero-sum game. And if they're getting education, that means that Tripp and Muffy must somehow be deprived.
Yep.
And it's a problem that can be solved.
But it starts with a conversation that West Virginia refused to have. this week.
Yeah, it does.
And I'm so glad that you have it, and I'm glad that Bernie is willing to have it. And I want to end on a positive note that I think more people, because of Trump, are opening their eyes, and I think we will go further, faster, in the better direction as opposed to the opposite direction. I at this point, that I have to believe that. Otherwise, I don't think I could do what I do every night like you do, because I'd be too demoralized. But I want to thank you again for the help with the article and everything else, and being a part of the network, and just in general, because when we talk, you enlighten me every time we talk. So
I always enjoy our conversations, Thomas. You have a good evening, my friend.
Yes, you too.
Okay, bye now. And hey, I ain't great, but we made it. It's about 4 minutes before the hour. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. I really appreciate it. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. I'm not feeling exactly stellar, but, you know, with another night's rest and another day's not eating, maybe things will get better. Maybe. By way of answering Thomas's question far better than I could have, Steve in China says, the living wage problem is simple to solve. You'll have to risk your life first, since the solution is about eliminating a handful of multi-billionaires who own 90% of all the money on the planet. Even when you can get one of the bastards to pay his or her taxes, this ties in with the energy problem too, since none of them would be very happy about what would become the richest continent of the new earth. Africa, anyone? Yeah. The number of people who are why we can't have nice things, I agree, Steve, in China, is a small number. That makes the problem solvable. But it's time to get out of here. Cross your fingers, I'll be back tomorrow night. We've got basically we've filled up the hole all the way to tonight. So we've got $200 left to raise. That means tomorrow night we got $400, and that's a hell of a lot less terrifying than $650. So thank you very kindly. And remember, there's an offer on the table, courtesy of Joan. Joan's got $50 with which to augment the next 3 subscribers between tonight and tomorrow night. It's 24 hours, actually 21. So please don't let it go by. And I'll just say this. We would be in far more desperate straits than we are now were it not for our subscribers. We would be in desperate straits. The straits are not exactly desperate. But we greatly appreciate our subscribers. So maybe take advantage of Joan's kind offer. Please do. It's easy. Just check the box at headonradionetwork.com under the tab Contribute. Make this a recurring monthly donation. And you'll be right there. So, thanks one and all. Time to get out of here. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you, Sparky, in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks so much for putting in the work to correct the damage done by the recent attack on the server. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACACT.org. But always, always, always. Gina, it's all for you. Good night, everybody.